Before we get started, let me remind you of an upcoming event. We're working with trying to restore as succinctly as possible the ancient wisdom so we can carry it forward into the next century and make some use out of the spiritual intelligence which we have sadly inherited the world where it has not been used for several generations now, and it's time to bring it back into use. And pursuant to this, on Tuesday nights I've been investigating for the last 3 or 4 years the basic archetype of the South, East, and West. For a year or so we did lectures completely on Taoism, and for the last year and a half or so on esoteric Egyptian Christianity. So we are trying to bring those investigations to practical exercises, practical points. And April 4th, which is a Tuesday, we'll be having a very special ceremony and critique here. And because you are all involved with the Saturday program, you get invitations. There'll be other people who, in my judgment, over the last 15 or so years in Los Angeles are able and ready to make use of it, and I'll invite those individually. But all of you, by right of being here on Saturday mornings, are welcome to come. So it'll be April 4th at 8 p.m. And we will be doing the Hermetic Wisdom Liturgy in its fully amended form. And my friend Sidney Lanier will come down from San Francisco again and be the elder in the situation. And we will have a select group of people. And the Tuesday night people who have been with me now for some time, some of them 3-4 years, will help put this on, and the rest of you are welcome to come and experience and observe, participate to whatever extent you wish to. But after the event, it shouldn't last more than about 40 minutes, 45 minutes, we'll have a break, a nourishment break. Hopefully we'll have something worth eating and drinking. And then we'll have a critical session of about an hour to try and consciously tease out of our own experience on the spot impressions, ideas, associations, and so forth. And hopefully the record of what takes place on April 4th will be a basis for completing the amending of this particular document. Now, I have resuscitated this document in its outline form, in its intellectual idea, to put it in the Greek phrase, because I'm capable of doing that. But only the actual practical conscious experience of a committed community of persons can flesh it out and bring out its actual ritual actions, its mythic images, its symbolic structures, its magical ambiance, its artistic unity, and its historical import, as well as its scientific exactness. Might as well put all seven in there. So that this is a serious endeavor, and it will have its consequences and repercussions in times to come. So you're all invited to participate in that and to come. That's Tuesday, April 4th. And because of Tuesday being a day when I'm here all day, any of you can come at any time during Tuesday. I'll be here except perhaps around noontime, but you can come and spend as long as you want, come as early as you want, and make yourself at home. But the performance, I guess I'll call it that, the performance is at 8 o'clock, Tuesday, April 4th. And it'll last for about 45 minutes. We'll have a break, and then we'll have an hour critique. And the critique will be as open as need be. And the form of a critique is the kind of criticism that an artistic director of a play administers after rehearsal. That's what a critique is. Only in this sense, all of the participants are the directors. And I don't know how many of you have ever been actors or actresses, but you know that a really good director makes the play in the critique. That's where the play is made, not on the page. The play is not on the page. The play is on the stage when it is done. And so the critique will be very, very important. So you're all invited to that. If you're interested, the blue pamphlet in this folder is the current state of the revised and printed up literary form of it. And after Tuesday, April 4th, I'll go through it again and revise it further with Sydney and my friend Stephen Schwartz. And we'll be able to, I think by, probably by May Day, have a text ready to be printed up. And in that case, those who are participating will receive a copy of it. Of course, you're encouraged to keep it under wraps as much as you can. This is not a contest for drawing in as many people as possible. This is a serious endeavor to do it right as best we can. So that announcement out of the way, we'll come back to our Saturday situation here. We have this week, and the next week will be the interspace between magic and art. So that next week, we're going to look at Ibn Arabi, The Journey to the Lord of Power. And if you have a copy of that, bring it next week. If you don't, we can make a few copies up. I think that'll be all right for our own use. It's not very long. At any rate, I'll have enough copies so that you can share them next week. So Ibn Arabi's Journey to the Lord of Power. It's a little paperback, and I'll bring my copy out again so that you can take a look at it. This week ends the section on magic. And let's recap where we are so that you can, in a strategic way, position your sense of form. This is a two-year program, and the first year is meant to just develop as much value and meaning and significance as is possible in that time period, to jam it full of nutrition. The second year is meant to put that into conscious motion and to spin out whatever forms and whatever nutritive values we can absorb and apply in that second year. So that the educational strategy is the classic one. You develop as broadly as you can a field of inquiry. Then you constellate as accurately as you can out of that field of inquiry whatever energies, whatever patterns, whatever forms can be actually established from that field of inquiry. Now, in ancient times, this form was the basic mode of all civilization. Every element in civilization was consonant with this basic mode. So this basic mode would be man's relationship to the cosmos and every other significant aspect of civilization were various epicycles of this grand strategic outlook. At the end of the first year, we had moved from nature to symbol. The basic movement of enrichment of our field of inquiry was to move from nature inwards towards a symbolic self. So that however you were able to construe nature at the beginning, as wide as you could make it, that was the effective cosmos that you actually were able to work in, to live in, to be extant in. And you can see, of course, that if one goes through this process a couple of times, you enlarge your capacity. This process is built to refine the person indefinitely. In other words, you could go through this. I've gone through this process about 9 times. And I must say, I learn every single time. It's never dull rote. I don't ever consider myself finished. I have never seen the repetition where I was bored. So every time one goes through this process, your sense of what is involved, for instance, now we're talking about nature, of what nature is, enlarges, deepens, enriches. And so one has more to work with. And just so, that movement from nature inward to the symbolic self deepens, enriches, becomes ever so much more scintillating, as like in a jewel, so that this process in the first year of enrichment is seeing that indeed the natural basis is a universal, rich sphere of possibility. The two major phases of interiorizing nature, the first phase is ritual. The second phase is language. What we do and what we say. What we actually do and what we actually say. But it takes some refinement to be able to become aware of actually what we do. So much of what we do is on a rote level, on a habitual level. And so traditional wisdom exercising was always inclusive of some ritual, not because they were still superstitious, but indeed because they were conscious that this was essential and necessary. So that rituals become more and more consciously informed, more and more symbolically charged, more and more affine to the conscious purposes of human wisdom. So that ritual, while it begins in a very phenomenological way, carries all the way through to the highest levels of realization. The yoga asana is a ritual comportment, just as much as the medicine man shaking his drum. So there's no sense here that one is primitive and the other is sophisticated. There's the sense here that one is refined from the other and that intelligence is keeping that perspective of enriched, the enriched spectrum alive, and not to overanalyze and overpolarize experience into superior and inferior. This has its own built-in comeuppance. So that ritual, we found, was the first transformation. And the characteristic essence of ritual is making a mask. Mask making is the essence of ritual. Now, a mask can be what you put on your face. A mask can also be the persona that you adopt in your work life, or the persona you adopt in some kind of relationship, or some kind of a mask form of identity that you assume for yourself in your own life, even though you might know better. So the mask is not just a medicine man accoutrement, but the mask as a phenomenon characterizes ritual, what we do, so that at the center of what we do is a projected face of ourselves. And usually on this level, it's a projected face of some basic capacity of ourselves. Now, we made two masks, one of some deep feeling that we had, and a second one of some characteristic food that we ate. So that one of the masks was from the inside that we take into ourselves and make a part of ourselves. The other mask was something from in ourselves that we characteristically express outward. And we saw that these two masks, the masks of something that we characteristically take in and something other that we characteristically express out, that if we position these two masks together, there is an interface between the two, which becomes available to consciousness when we go through this mask-making exercise and put those two masks together. That interface becomes visible. And that interface is the threshold of your actual capacity to change. Your actual ability to change is quite a real dynamic capacity. It's almost like a barrier which is infinitely elastic, but nevertheless is a barrier, and one must deal with its elasticity. You can't hope for the impossible and expect that by some gambling randomness it just might come true. One has to be as conscious as you can that this is what you're working with. You're working with this dynamic energy, this elasticity of revising what you do. And if we can revise what we do, we revise the mask residency. We revise the whole basis upon which we occur. The second transformation was language, that the appropriation of language in all of its various ramifications and forms, the appropriation of language, that mythic capacity to express meaning, and that basically in a mythological mode, the meaning occurs within a feeling tone, so that language of feeling is characteristic of the movement of mythic images. So much so that in any effective analysis, if you deal with a very powerful constellation of feeling, if you deal effectively with it, if you are able in some kind of therapeia to come into real existential contact with a feeling-toned complex, you can, in every instance, resolve that feeling-toned complex into an image. The whole science of a therapeia from ancient Egypt right up until 1989 is the ability for someone to be able to do this. And an effective therapist is someone who helps us to do this. To do what? To on the first level, be aware of what we do do, so that we can characterize it accurately to ourselves, and then to be able to resolve feeling matrices or feeling tone complexes, as has come into the language. They're actually not complexes, but they're matrices. Their structure is a matrix and not a complex. It's a holdover from the 19th century to call it complexes, but since it's in the language, we just do it. But their actual structural form is a matrix and not a complex. But to resolve that to the image that is there, to put it in a colloquial term, every deep feeling has an image at the bottom of it. And to be able to see what that image is the effective part of a therapeia. What is the effective part? Because then one can relate what you actually do to the interior sense of self, your inner self. The bridge from what you do to your inner self is all in terms of this image base, which generally is covered up by feeling, by feeling tone, by not being able to resolve those feeling tones into images. One just reacts to the feeling. And often, because recursive action is much more hypnotic than any kind of direct action, your struggle and combat with those feelings on the feeling level are what enmesh you and ensnare you. That's what karma is that process right there. By resolving it into the feeling-toned images, by establishing your image base, by getting your myths into a mythology, one is able then to have a bridge, and language is a bridge. It's a basic communication always between what we do, what we actually do, and the doer, who we actually really are, the deep self inside. So that the first year of the program was all towards sensitizing ourselves as much as possible to this ecology. And we took nature for 3 months, we took ritual for 3 months, we took myth for 3 months, and we took symbols for 3 months. And we tried not to make too much out of it in terms of powerful ideas. Why? Because we're all very good at ideas. We have tremendously strong minds. We live in the late 20th century and we love to have ideas. And when there's an ebullience that we have. It's almost like having wealth to be able to understand something and to know how it works. But that ideational premature growth blocks us out from the ritual and mythic and symbolic activities that are essential later on to consciousness. Without those roots really being established, we're like one of those plants that you buy at a supermarket that has a forest bloom, and it blooms for a couple of days and shines really good and then dies and is not able to come back. We want to have really good roots so that when the season comes for us to bloom, we can bloom every year. And we can come back if we wish, however many lifetimes we need for whatever work we need. So we have to have those kinds of basic root structures that allow us to reoccur as we see the need to be. And so the first year is that kind of enrichment. But we saw that there's a tremendous power that is engendered. And you can think colloquially of the fact it's just like if you took an expanse of gas and you compress that expanse of gas, it builds up pressure. It builds up an internal dynamic. And if you compress it, if you compress all of the possible experience of nature, even on a watered-down sense of someone, psyche, into that very, very small comparative space of the interior of oneself, you can see what kind of dynamic there is. Its nature then, because it's under pressure, is to expand back out. That expansion back out has a wave form, and that energy that expands back out from that's consciousness. And it has a very distinctive waveform able to be calibrated. It is not a fiction. Consciousness in its first phase of coming out is magic, psychic energy. And it has all of the distinctive marks of recent symbolic integration, so that magic is always symbolically informed, so that the language of magic, unlike the language of myth, has a symbolic tone to it all the time. That if you resolve magical language, you do not come up with an image at the basis of feeling, but you come up with a form at the basis of thought. So that the thinking function with forms to it is what characterizes a magical language. For instance, the ancient star here, this particular magical banner, has the livery of Sir Gawain from the Arthurian cycle. And it is the esoteric star, the five-pointed star by a single line moving. It's the eternal star on the field of living blood, the crimson of living blood. It's been exposed to the sun, so it's somewhat faded to a vermilion, so it's like old stained blood from ancient wounds, if you will, to be romantic and poetic. And it's a banner that I myself have earned the right to have, various wars and things. This star is the symbol of the self, but its radiant field of living blood is that magical realm of its application. Now you can see it in this kind of a form, like on a banner, or you could see it in a highly intellectual form as being the interior star of the self and the whole of the blood vessels of your body as the field of the blood. Those of you who are with me in the Upanishad series on Thursday night recall that in the Prashna Upanishad, the sage Pipalada tells the form of the mandala of the blood system. There are 101 arteries, and each one of those has 100 sub-arteries, and each one of those has 72,000 arteries. And it's like 1, 2, 3 infinity. It's like giving you an imaginative symbolic image, 101, and then raising it exponentially, each one of those 100, and then fanning it out in an explosion of unfollowed amplitude, unfollowable amplitude, 72,000 for each one of those. So in the Prashna Upanishad, one has the image of the body, the human body, as an almost infinite field of blood coming from the interior self, the inner star. And the human body in this sense, this magical sense, is a cosmos in itself on the move, extremely potent, extremely capable. This banner of Sir Gawain is a Celtic symbol of that same symbolic understanding. The Arthurian cycle is very related to India and Egypt. In fact, the whole swath of consciousness there is all of one piece, has been for untold thousands of years. This section on magic, then, has been the first release of symbolic pressure. The release of what? The release of meaning. Because with just a gas, you just have a mechanical pressure. But with a self, the pressure is in meaning. So the self has built up all meaning. However much meaning you are capable of establishing, all of that is focused in the self, so that you can see that your self is extremely powerful, extremely capacious. But notice this. If you extend your basis, if you take your consciousness back into this cycle of growth, you can not only be born again, but you can grow again. You can go through the phases of life again, only this time being your own conscious tutor, your own conscious tutorial spirit. You have your conscious self join and be a conscious companion and take yourself through it again. And when you do, you learn that everything now is done exponentially, so that when it comes to focusing meaning in yourself, yourself now has an exponential of the meaning that it originally had. And understanding that this is possible and capable, one can take oneself back with an exponential self and take oneself through again. And that third time, as the colloquial phrase has it, the third time pays for all. Because one learns then that there is no limitation whatsoever. And so if you do it a third time with an infinite exponential, the self that was established, the infinite meaning, worthy of appearing before God, worthy in every sense. So that this process that we're involved in here has a lot of possibilities, to put it mildly. But the possibilities are crimped by presupposed ideas, presupposed opinions that are still left over from the time that we had when we grew up before we went through this process. In other words, this last year that you had here, and some of you even were not here for the whole of the year. You already had 35, sometimes 45 years of life before that, of all kinds of presuppositions, all kinds of prejudices, all kinds of expectations, all kinds of habits that are still carried over. So now when we're in the magic section, when the basic tone is for this symbolic expansion to happen and to cue in consciousness, like old memories, like old associations, these meanings filter in and affect, I almost say infect. If I were speaking medically, would infect what happens? The basic infection comes from the old ego, which senses somehow that it is threatened by this procedure, especially in the magic. It subconsciously senses the threat in the mask assignment. And there are many people who have very strong intellectual predilections who do not survive beyond the mask assignment. Some of you who have been here for a while have seen this before. There are many people who seemingly are very intelligent people, very together seemingly, do not survive in this situation beyond the mask assignment. They do not survive beyond the magic part of this assignment at all if they've toughed it through even from the naked section. Why is this so? Because the ego is threatened, it knows that by this point, almost in a conscious, cunning, clever sense, that conditions are changing. It's not going to be able to play its old games anymore in this person, in this body, in this life. This body, this person, this life is too rich for this landlord to keep afloat. Too ambidextrous for the old centers of authority and power to maintain themselves. And so that ego sabotages the operation as much as possible, gives us all the good whispered rationalizations in our ear, in our eye, in our mind, of why we can't go on, of why this isn't all that important. And it's almost like a classic case. The most beautiful, humane, elegant presentation of this dialogue is in the Bhagavad Gita. And it's Arjuna who gives all these rationalizations to Krishna. He tells him every single beautiful rationalization of why he can't go in and fight. And Krishna listens like a messenger from God always listens with bright eyes and accepts everything he says and says it's beautiful, well-reasoned, elegant, but they have nothing to do with the actual situation. The actual situation is that you are about to wake up. And when you awaken, maybe none of these rationalizations will even apply to you. So why don't you wake up first and then see. Then see what holds. But the ego doesn't want to wake up because the ego is a product of semi-somnambulance. And he wants you to wake up. And when grabbed by the nape of the neck, the ego finally will confess, finally will scream it out in some kind of frustrated whisper, but I don't want to die. I want to be alive. And the pathos can get you. And if you have any kind of dramatic sensitivity and integrity, you tell it what a wonderful performance. This ensures the fact that there must be some place for you. We'll find a place for you to be just like you are. And you'll be happy because you'll be able to be just like you are, like you really are, and you won't have to be pretending anymore that you're divine and all these other things that are so hard for you. And you can, in this way, help that inner child grow up and not feel that, oh, I don't want to go. I don't want to do that. I won't be able to do that, say. I can't see myself doing it. So in this part of the growth, the transition from magic to art is the essential conscious transformation. The essential conscious transformation is to come out of the psychic energy in the form of the person who you really are. The birth of the person is the essence of art. That's why art is valuable. Art is the most valuable thing that civilization has. Do you think that oil wells and gold mines and real estate are valuable? Those people that have oil wells and gold mines and real estate invested in art. Because art is the ultimate personal value. The ultimate personal value. If one understands consciously and is struggling with this, a work of art is like a companion in this activity. Becomes like a talisman for the very life energy that you're seeking to bring out, and the person emerges from that. That's why in this transition between magic and art, I use Ibn Arabi. Because Ibn Arabi is a consummate artist above everything else. He not only is one of the world's greatest mystics, but above and beyond that, he's one of the great artists of the world. He was able to write a kind of mystical symbolic poetry which is just exquisite. And the journey to the Lord of Power that we're using here is one of his most incisive of all his artistic writing. It's poetic about the very process that is happening in this transition or transformation. We can make it that strong. It's a transformation. What is transforming? The psychic energy patterned around the self, the new self, is coming into conflict with the old psychic energy patterns constellated around the ego. And in that conflict of that two, a third has to come out, like a vector comes out. And that new vector is one's new self, one's new person, new life. La vita nueva. The new life comes out of that. Notice, it isn't the self, however gorgeous it is, in its raw, naked power, but it's what is able to be lived in this life with the situations that you actually have. You don't have to come out like Krishnamurti on his stick chair. He did that because that was the life he had to live. His almost pure self, almost pure inner deep person. As pure as ivory silk, about 99.44% yogic pure. He really did it right then. But that for us would not be it. That for us would be another mask, would be another mythological surrogate, and is not the thing to settle for, is not the right vector. What is right is the person who you really are in this life that you really are living. That person has every right to be freed, every right to live this life which is for that person. And in a Socrates way, when he said, I'm a midwife of ideas, if there's any function that I can perform, it's being a midwife for that real person, who you really are. And I'm not the least bit entranced with almost near perfect yogis. I must tell you, it doesn't make any difference to me. What is valuable, and with great tenacity, I can prove it again and again, is for to be born out of you, that person who you really are. Whoever that person is. Because that person is going to use the life that you really can live to its optimum. And that adds a jewel-like precious value to this cosmos. And every time that happens, it changes the mix of this universe. And that is what is essential. Now, in order to stymie the old ego, because the battle with the old ego in its old patterns is almost like an Armageddon sometimes. It is, as far as you're concerned, the most difficult thing that you can ever do. And to put it colloquially, the challenge is always 100%. What is required of you is 100%. So that you cannot give 99% and keep an ace in the hole for emergency. The transformation requires 100%. And this requires a very peculiar kind of courage. Not a courage which says, well, I'll do the best I can, meaning that I'll work at it until I can't anymore. It means that you will do all that you can. You don't play out. If anything plays out, it's the circumstances. It's that kind of courage. You don't ever call it quits. It may be that you might in this lifetime be outdistanced by circumstance. It does happen. It does happen. The great English composer Ralph Vaughan Williams wrote a musical expression of that kind of a journey based on Commander Scott's Antarctic expedition and von Williams' Seventh Symphony, the Symphonia Antarctica.